Chapter 17. Knights and Samurai, the English Code of Chivalry. The knights who lived in England's castles got their land from the king because they were good fighters. They were better at fighting than at anything else. So when there were no wars to fight in, these knights wandered around the countryside fighting. They threatened peasants, rode over the crops, killed animals, raided monasteries, and stole from churches. So the leaders of the Christian church began to teach that knights owed loyalty to God, not just to the king. A knight had a sacred duty to defend the church and to take care of the weak, women, monks and priests, widows and orphans. Knights were supposed to be more than just good fighters. They were like policemen, responsible for protecting others and making sure that laws were obeyed. This new way of being a knight was called chivalry. Chivalry meant that a knight had to be brave, loyal, honest, generous, and good at fighting. He had to fight for the church whenever it was threatened. He had to love his country, honor his lord, and fight his country's enemies. Most of all, he had to protect women. And if a knight fell in love with a lady, he had to promise to serve her and to do any task she gave him, no matter how difficult it was. Becoming a knight was a long, complicated process. When you were 7, you would begin to learn how to ride and how to fight with a sword and spear. Your family might send you to stay with another family so that you could train with other boys. In this training camp, you become a page. You learn how to put on heavy armor and how to carry your shield properly. You learn how to take care of a horse and how to clean your saddle and bridle. You might even practice charging with a spear. But your spear is a broom handle, and your horse is a wooden horse with wheels pulled by other pages. When you are 14 or so, you become a servant to one particular knight. Now you are called a squire. You look after the knight's horse and armor, help him to put his armor on and take it off, clean his armor and weapons after a fight, and take care of all his needs. In the meantime, you go on learning how to fight, and you also learn how to be polite, how to speak courteously and eat neatly, how to carve meat and serve it, and how to behave at a great feast. Finally, you go through a ceremony in which you become a knight. You go to the Lord's castle and spend an entire night praying in the castle chapel. The next morning, you take a cold bath and dress in 3 colors, a white shirt to remind you of purity, a red cloak to remind you of the blood you will spill as a knight, and brown pants to remind you of the earth where your body will be buried. You go to the great hall of the castle, where you swear always to be faithful to the church and to your lord. The lord taps you with a sword and announces, "Now you are a knight." He gives you a sword of your own, and a priest blesses you. Now you have a squire of your own, and you can take part in the first big tournament of the year. Hundreds of knights will be fighting in this tournament. You have your own colorful tent on the tournament grounds, where your squire helps you get dressed in your armor. Knights used to wear chainmail, made out of thousands of tiny steel rings linked together. But this chainmail won't stop the blade of an axe or the point of a lance. So instead, you wear armor made out of plates of steel hinged together. First, your squire helps you put on a thick padded jacket to cushion your armor. Then he helps you step into the plate armor legs of your suit. He fastens a chainmail skirt around your waist and then straps on your back plate, your breastplate, and your arm and shoulder guards. You're starting to feel hot, but you're not done yet. You put on leather gloves and pull on plate mail gloves or gauntlets over top of them. Your squire straps your sword onto your belt and puts your helmet on. It covers your whole face, except for narrow eye slits where you can see out. Your friends only recognize you because of the special symbol painted on your shield. This symbol, or coat of arms, tells everyone who you are. It is painted with gold and scarlet paint so that the other knights can see it far away. You walk stiffly out of the tent and over to your horse. You are so heavy that your squire has to hoist you onto your horse with a rope thrown over a tree branch. You join a parade of other knights riding in front of the ladies of the court. The ladies look carefully at all the coats of arms. If they recognize a knight who has broken the rules of chivalry and been rude to a lady, they can point at him and the heralds will order him out of the tournament. But no one points at you, and finally it is time for you to joust. Your squire gives you a blunt-ended lance, and you trot down to the end of the ring and turn around. Another knight is waiting to charge at you. The herald gives the signal, and you kick your horse into a gallop. The other knight looks enormous, thundering towards you on a huge black charger. You grit your teeth and close your eyes and feel an enormous jolt on your lance arm. For a minute you think you're going to fall backwards off your horse, but you manage to catch onto the high front of your saddle and pull yourself upright as your horse gallops on towards the end of the ring. You hear the crowd shouting your name. As soon as you can pull your horse up, you wheel around to look for your opponent. His horse is galloping off into the distance, and he's sitting on the ground with his shattered lance in his hand. You've won the joust. The Samurai, Japanese Knights. Knights and lords were part of English life during the Middle Ages, but England wasn't the only country that had a feudal system, where knights swore to obey lords in exchange for land. Far, far to the east, a very different country also had knights and lords, only in this country, the knights were called samurai. We've already learned about Japan, which lies right off the coast of the giant country of China. If you were to go from England across the sea to France, where the Normans live, and then travel east, you would go through wild, mountainous country, inhabited by nomadic tribes that no one in England knows much about. If you kept traveling east, you would reach the Black Sea and then the Caspian Sea. Down to the south is the Arabian Peninsula, where Muhammad was born. Keep going east and you'll pass through Central Asia. If you look down to the south now, you'll see India. But you're not in China yet. Travel east a little more until you see the shores of the Yellow River in front of you. Now you're in China. Follow the Yellow River all the way to the coast of China. Cross over the Yellow Sea, and you'll see the southern tip of Japan. Japan and England are both islands, but the two islands could not be more different. England is one large island. Japan is made up of four long, thin islands, surrounded by almost 4,000 smaller ones. And while England is a peaceful island covered with forests and calm fields, Japan's islands have 65 active volcanoes. The Japanese islands were formed by the collision of two parts of the Earth's crust, which pushed up against each other and formed a ridge with molten lava beneath it. This lava still boils up through the crust and erupts through Japan's volcanoes. And throughout Japan, hot springs called onsen bubble and steam up from the earth, heated by the molten rock beneath the surface. Japanese samurai used to bathe in these hot springs. We've already read about the Yamato emperors of Japan who wanted Japan to develop its own way of life rather than borrowing the Chinese ways of living. At the same time that William the Conqueror became King of England, a Yamato emperor was still ruling in Japan. But this emperor, who lived in a huge, elaborate palace, was treated more like a god than like an emperor. He was almost never seen, and he certainly didn't run his country. He left all of that to his noblemen, who were called daimyos. But the daimyos quarreled with each other and didn't take care of the country either. Laws began to break down. Robbers roamed from place to place, taking whatever they liked. And these noblemen found that they needed protection for themselves and for their land. So the daimyos hired warriors to protect them. They promised these warriors land and money, and these warriors, called samurai, promised in return to protect the daimyos and their land from bandits. Just like English knights, samurai took land from a lord, the daimyo, and gave service in return. And just like English knights, the samurai gave pieces of land to peasants who worked on the land and grew food for the samurai. Japan, like England, had a feudal system. Peasants worked for the samurai served the daimyos, and the daimyos served the emperor. The samurai also wore armor, but their armor was made out of iron plates, lacquered with bright colors, and tied together with silk and leather strips. The lacquer paint kept the iron from rusting in Japan's damp air, and their helmets were shaped into faces, often with elaborate iron mustaches and painted to look snarling and fierce. They spent years learning how to fight with special curved swords called katanas. Young samurai were taught to perform different sword strokes, named after animals like the cat, the monkey, and the bird. Many samurai thought that their katanas had magical powers. They hired skilled swordsmiths to make the swords and to decorate them with gold, jewels, and figures of dragons. Just like English knights, samurai lived in castles. But Japan had more wood than stone, and although the castles had stone foundations, their walls and towers were often made of timber. Knights in England followed the code of chivalry, but samurai had their own code called the Way of the Warrior. A samurai always had to defend his daimyo, or lord, no matter what. And if he had to fight for his lord, he was required to win or die. To be taken prisoner was a terrible humiliation for a samurai. If he showed cowardice or fear of death, he was expected to kill himself with a special sword in a complicated ceremony called seppuku. But these fierce warriors also wrote poetry and made beautiful gardens. Many samurai wrote short poems called haiku in praise of nature. Here is a medieval Japanese haiku written by the great samurai Mitsuo Basho. This ancient pond here, a frog jumps into the pond. Sound of the water. The gardens of these fierce warriors were full of quiet ponds, lovely flowing streams, moss-covered banks, and peaceful patterns raked into expanses of white sand. Samurai even learned how to dance gracefully. As a matter of fact, one of the greatest samurai warriors ever, General Oda Nobunaga, did a beautiful dance with a fan in front of his soldiers before leading them into war. Nobunaga became the most powerful soldier in Japan, but he still knew how to dance. Samurai used to say, "Practice the arts of peace on the left hand and the arts of war on the right." That meant that they didn't fight all the time, only when they needed to, and in times of peace, they spent their time gardening, writing, and painting instead.